Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Episode of the Inside Lacrosse Division I podcast featuring Mark Dixon. I'm your host, Dan Flynn, and we are recording from the worldwide headquarters of Inside Lacrosse in our newly renovated podcast studio. Dix, what do you think of our new digs here?
It's nice. We're a little secluded, a little more intimate, but it's definitely very primitive.
It's cozy. It's cozy.
Yeah.
We will continue to improve this space. Our studio that we're building here. As we launch several new podcasts, our schedule again is Dan Ahern and Kyle Devitt will do a weekend recap with immediate hot takes from the weekend and cover all the big games. Mark and I will come to you on Wednesdays with his takeaways and sort of a big picture of what's happening in the college lacrosse world. And then Terry and Quint will come out on Friday mornings with what's happened in the week, what's developed over the course of the week in the college game, and then their predictions and talk about the games coming up over the weekend. So speaking of weekends, Dix, how was your weekend? I saw that your son, Owen, placed in a wrestling tournament. You probably spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, so North County High School on Saturday afternoon in Glen Burnie was the site of the MSWA, the Maryland State Wrestling Association Age Weight Championships.
You were over in the People's Republic of Glen Burnie?
People's Republic
of
Glen
Burnie. I was over
there, too. Where were you?
Well, actually, I was in Linthicum. I was at the St. Philip Neri School.
I was right up the street.
Really?
We drove by St. Philip Neri three times on Saturday.
Yeah, watching intramural first, second, and third grade basketball. My nephew,
nice.
Jimmy, was over there playing. And it was, let me just say one girl lit it up. I think her name was either Maggie or Teresa. I couldn't really get, but she had 8 points in this game. I was very impressed with her. My nephew, he played. Back to the, it was kind of like watching a wrestling match a little bit.
Co-ed league?
Yeah, co-ed.
Co-ed
girls
league.
Boys, yeah.
Look at you. All right. Yeah, so, Owen is 12 years old. He was in the 12 under age group, and he's 115 pounds.
How many weight classifications is that?
I'd have to look. I think there's so on Saturday it was 10 and under and 12 and under, and then yesterday, this past Sunday was 8 under, 14 under, and I think there might be 10, 12 weight classes in each age group. I'd have to go back and look, but he's 115 and placed fourth.
That's great.
So he lost to the eventual runner-up in the second round, made a mistake and paid for it. That's the beauty and the agony of wrestling is you just make one slight mistake or you capitalize on one slight mistake and it could be the match. But I was interested. We were really proud of Owen was he won his first round match, lost in the second round, so now he's in the consolation mm-hmm. bracket. He won three consecutive matches by pinfall to get to the third place match, was up 2-1 in the going into the third period, and it was his choice, so he chose the down position, figuring it's just an escape, and he's back in business. And the kid that he was wrestling against was just really, really talented, really strong, and made a move at the end and grabbed an ankle pick, as they like to call it, and got some points that way, so Owen lost by a couple of points. But great weekend. My older boy played basketball this weekend, so we were running back and forth between Halethorpe, Maryland, Towson, Maryland, Glen Burnie, Maryland, and then in between watched lacrosse.
Yeah.
On Sunday when things slowed down a little bit, was able to catch some replays and some video of some of the great lacrosse that was played this weekend. So sounds like we're both busy watching youth sports, sprinkled in with our responsibilities as college lacrosse analysts, aficionados, hosts, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, definitely had to do the family stuff, but then getting in the lacrosse when you can. 1 o'clock was a big hour for me. There was a basketball game I wanted to watch on TV, but then I had the Hopkins game against UMBC and the Loyola game against Virginia lacrosse games on simultaneously. So It was an exciting mid. It's nap time for me when kid goes to take a nap. So it was a great 2 hour window for me. And let's get right into it, Dix. Number 15, Virginia, Lars Tiffany's debut, goes to Ridley Field, and they upset number 5, Loyola, 16-15 in a classic game. Docs Aiken, 4 goals in his first game. Ryan Conrad was spectacular. Some great defense on some of Loyola's big guns to shut them down and keep them quiet at least. What are the takeaways from this one?
Going into this game, I had it as a pick 'em. Loyola's a team, I think, built to go back to championship weekend. Virginia is a team, along with Penn State, that I think is going to be the most improved in 2017. And this is a program that has not been to the NCAA quarterfinals, I believe, since 2012. First round exits prior to last season when the Virginia didn't even make the NCAA tournament. So takeaways in this one, both these teams have some pretty good offenses. These guys can score goals. And when you look at the score sheet and you see for Loyola, Pat Spencer and Brian Sherlock held to 0 goals.
Crazy.
Romar Dennis as well. And you're still able to put 15 goals up. That's pretty impressive. I think going into this game, you would have thought Virginia's going to win a lot of these games, 14-13s, 16-15s, 15-14s, because Matt Barrett is gone in goal. Tanner Scales is back on defense, but this is a defense in Charlottesville that's been, it's had more holes than Swiss cheese over the last couple of seasons. But to see Loyola give up these many goals is a little startling. So let's start with Loyola's defense. Right off the bat, you see Jacob Stover struggled, and we've talked in the previous weeks, will Jacob Stover have PTSD from the championship weekend last year when he was shellacked against North Carolina? But I think the shots that Virginia was able to generate were products of some of the mistakes by the Loyola defense. So right then and there, you really can't pin it on Jacob Stover. But now going into next week's game, is there a goalie controversy in Evergreen? I don't think so. I think you still stick with Stover, but Lamone came in, played better than Stover, settled down a little bit. Neither were spectacular. I mean, they made 5 total saves.
Right.
So that's one. The second thing is Alex McGovern, transfer from North Carolina. His father played at Loyola. Chris McGovern was a member of the 1990 national runner-up that the Greyhounds had, and Alex spent his freshman year at North Carolina, had some adversity this summer, and got an opportunity to play at Loyola. Had the opportunity to go back to North Carolina, chose to stay a little closer to home and become a Greyhound. And how about his debut? 2 goals and 3 assists on a day where the big guns were shut down. Just adds to their depth and their talent at the midfield. So those are my 2 biggest takeaways in this game, just kind of top level for Loyola. Now, Virginia, on the other hand, they seem to have embraced Lars Tiffany, his up-tempo style. Virginia and up-tempo kind of go hand in hand, but the last couple of years, Virginia really hasn't had, I don't know if it's because they didn't have the horses, they didn't have the game plan, they didn't have the proper personnel on the field, they just didn't seem to be able to really play at this tempo, play at this pace, and be successful. And they were able to do that on Saturday. Docs Aiken, a tremendous freshman, 4 goals.
They call him first years.
That's right.
Let me go down
to Charlottesville. Yeah, the first year. The
first years.
Not allowed to live on the lawn until 4th year, right? And stay out of the Biltmore as well, or the Biltmore. So first year, Docs Aiken, tremendous game. Ryan Conrad, I saw it in the scrimmage against Maryland. He was lights out. He was fantastic on Saturday for Virginia. Zed Williams struggled a little bit. Looked like he got taken out of the game. And that's what I really liked about Lars Tiffany's approach. And what I like about Lars Tiffany in general, a lot of coaches just kind of they kind of ride their guys, feast or famine. I do it as a youth coach. You know, you have certain guys that you have a lot of trust in, a lot of faith in, and even when they're struggling, you're like, well, the next play they're going to get it. Well, then the next play they're going to get it. Well, sometimes they need to take some time and just collect their thoughts, get on the side, get a little bit of talking to, and just make some adjustments. And I think Williams did that. He ended up with a goal and 3 assists. He played much better after he came back into the game So a tremendous game. Last year, Loyola smoked Virginia 11-4. Previous to that, it's been all one-goal games, won by Virginia. Virginia wins this one by a goal. So just a very entertaining lacrosse game, and two solid teams offensively. Defensively, they got some things to figure out.
Is this one of those examples where it was a great game, fun to watch? We learned a little bit about each program, but don't take the result too seriously. Like, it's not the end of the world for Loyola. They got to get ready for their next game against Hopkins and move on.
We're sitting here on Valentine's Day. So, yeah, absolutely. There's so much lacrosse left to be played. But when you have 13 goals scored in the fourth quarter, that's pretty that's sweet. That is fun lacrosse. You want to, you know, George Costanza, you know, walk out, hey, thank you very much. You know, want them coming back, looking at more. 13 goals, 7 by Loyola, 6 by Virginia in that final fourth quarter. Very, very entertaining.
Another thing that was cool about this game, I watched this on Twitter. Yeah. And it's the first time I've done that where I've watched a live sporting event on Twitter. It was cool to see that there was a you know, worldwide possible audience for it. And the broadcast was pretty good. Coach Cottle was on there. I enjoyed watching it. It was fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that was the first thing I noticed when I started watching the game was Coach Cottle's voice and his take on the game. Chris Gunkel, who's done Loyola lacrosse for years, always does a great job. So it was neat to see it on Twitter. I guess the television guy in me is like, well, if you get that game on Twitter, why can't we get it on television? Yeah. That's a question. You know, a local outlet, Comcast Sportsnet maybe, or a Mid-Atlantic Sports Network, something along those lines. But it was really, really cool to see it on Twitter.
Yeah, moving on. Next game, number 2 Maryland sinks number 11 Navy in Annapolis, 15-12. Matt Rambo, 3 goals, 3 assists. Colin Heacock, 2 goals, 3 assists. Good showing by the Terps in their first time out.
It is, and this is what you expected, a very potent attack led by Rambo and Heacock. Then you throw Dylan Maltz in there. I mean, they've got 9 of the 15 goals by Maryland were scored by that high-powered attack. You need some players to pick up the slack at the midfield, especially for scoring for Maryland this year. And my biggest takeaway from this game was Connor Kelly showed up like you thought he would, 2 goals and an assist. But how about the freshman, Jared Bernhardt, the third member of the Bernhardt family to wear the black and red of the Maryland Terrapins?
So Bernhardt played very well. He scored a goal right before halftime that really gave the Terps an emotional edge going into the break. And Christian Sweezy has a good post up, a good article about Jared Bernhardt and his sort of evolution, always wanting to be a Terp, and how he is a very a student of the game, very smart, and even John Chilman referenced how smart of a player he was in his postgame comments.
Yeah, when you have the lineage and the family that Bernhardt does with the two older brothers having played at Maryland and had success at Maryland, he's really hit the ground running. And this is a guy who Maryland has been excited about to get on campus for a couple of years now. And he had a great debut, a goal and an assist. How about Matt Neufeld returning after the knee injury from a year ago? 6 ground balls, a career high. And that's the type of effort that Maryland is going to need.
He had a goal and an assist, too.
Yeah, he did, yeah. But, of course, the LSMs, it's all about the ground balls and the takeaways and, of course, putting the ball in the net and that kind of thing. But, you know, watching a player like Neufeld, you know, much like Larkin Kemp, you know, from Brown, you just are amazed at the number of ground balls that they're able to come up with. And I thought Neufeld was terrific. But there's not a lot of depth here. You know, Maltz, Rambo, Heacock, Connor Kelly were your multiple goal scorers. Bernhardt, Neufeld, and then Henningsen was able to get one off of the faceoff, and then Brzezowski, a new player, getting some time this year for the Terps. You need to develop a little bit more depth there. I think you saw that in Virginia and Loyola with all the different scores throughout the score sheet. You know, and then you look at a team like Navy. I think they're 2 games in now. They're 0-2, losing to Hopkins, losing to Maryland. They're still trying to adjust to life after Patrick Kina, the quarterback of their offense. Still trying to adjust with life without John Connor, their longtime starter who graduated a year ago. And Casey Reese is out, but I think you have to be happy with the production that you've seen out of the midfield so far, mostly Grayson Terrain and Colin Flaunlacker. And DJ Plumer showed up with a goal against against Maryland. He's a guy that's had success in his first couple of years in Annapolis. So Navy, although they're 0-2, they played two of the better teams so far, you know, a couple weeks in here in the new season, and they've got a lot to build on.
Yeah, they have a game against Delaware coming up this Saturday that should be a good game and a good chance for Navy also to maybe get their first win.
Delaware can score goals. They scored 18 this past weekend against Mount St. Mary's, an 18-5 win. They can face off well. I saw them in person against Bucknell in their opening season, one-goal loss. So what was it, a 14-13, 15-14 loss, and then they hang 18.
That, 14-13.
That team can score goals.
Yeah.
So that'll be a good test for this Navy defense.
And Will Kern, a Delaware kid, played at Slazy Annum, their freshman goalie, will be coming back. I think the game's in Newark, and will be a homecoming for him, and it'll be important for him to have a good game against the Hens and their scoring machine.
No question. And I tell you what, though, Navy, they gave up 15 to Hopkins. They gave up 15 to Maryland. I'm still a big believer in that defense. Chris Fennell, I mean, they're big. They're athletic. They're very, very talented. Kern played well in the first half against Hopkins, struggled in the second half. But this is a team that's going to get better as the season goes on.
Dix, maybe the biggest upset of the weekend, Monmouth, a fourth-year program, defeats number 16 Villanova on the road 12-10. Tyler Kleene led Monmouth with four goals. And it's exciting to see these young programs sort of get their first signature win.
Yeah, I always celebrate a new program getting their first victory. I remember I did that a couple years ago with Monmouth after they won their first game in program history. And then you look for conference wins. You know, you try to then be competitive in your conference. And, you know, Monmouth is a team that's been building slowly but surely. And then you look for a takedown of a national power. And Villanova is a consistent program, very talented, came into this game, I believe, ranked, depending on what poll you're looking at, 14, 15, 16.
16.
Big win for Monmouth. And, you know, 5-5 at the half, and at the end of 3-7-7 to win that fourth quarter on the road against a talented team like Villanova, that says a lot about this Monmouth lacrosse team. So the good news is they got the upset win. The bad news is they're not going to sneak up on anybody. And you got to look at, when you look at the score as well, 4-2 at the end of the first period, Villanova on top, 19-3 shot advantage for the Wildcats. That's something, if you're Villanova, you're probably scratching your head. You dominated faceoffs in that first quarter. You take 19 shots and you only come away with four goals. I mean, that's something that Coach Mike Corrado and his boys are going to be kicking themselves on. But again, you just really have to tip your cap to the Monmouth, the job done by that lacrosse team. And you know, how about their goaltender? Came up with 15 saves between the pipes. Nick Horeshko, beautiful job by Horeshko getting that win. And you know, again, you look for that takedown, and Monmouth now has a takedown win over a top 20 team that is monumental. And it's still early in the season, but this could spur that team on to bigger and better things.
So what's next for a program like that? Just showing consistency?
You have to. You can't, just when they're, you know, Mama's taken a lot of losses in the first couple of years of existence, they can't get too low because they have to realize that on any given day they can rise up and beat a team like Villanova. Same token, you know, it's February. We're on Valentine's Day. It's February 14th. There's nothing to celebrate so far. Enjoy the evening after the game and then get right back to work. And I think that's where Monmouth is right now. So it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. You got to, you know, you take the good with the bad, and you don't get too low with the worst, and you don't get too high with the good. And, you know, you just got to keep working.
Another team that's off to a good start, two games under their belt now. They started the season beating Navy last week, 15-8. Got a win on Saturday at home against UMBC, 15-5. It's the Hopkins Blue Jays. They have a big game coming up this weekend against Loyola. Bit of a rivalry game, Charles Street rivalry. Dix, after seeing the Blue Jays for two outings now, what's your take on the Jays and where they are?
I think the first thing that jumps out is how good offensively this team was a year ago without Joel Tinney, Connor Reed, Alex Kincannon, Drew Sapinski. The fact that they were able to score as many goals as they were last year really with just smoke and mirrors, not many guys that could break down a defense up top. I think that's a testament to the job offensive coordinator Bobby Benson has done with this team as well as the players. Fast forward a year, this team is deep. They've got a lot of scoring options. Joel Tinney was tremendous in the season opening win against Navy. You've got Kincannon is quick. You know, Connor Reed still has that dodge, but I think him and Sapinski are still showing some signs of rust and coming back. But, you know, you throw in a Cole Williams who's dangerous and a matchup nightmare all over the field.
Crawley's a solid
Crawley is the leader. I mean, he's the leader of that team and has been for the last 2-3 seasons. He's a captain. And you can slide him down to attack and steal some minutes, or you put him at the midfield. Eisler is another one that's dangerous, you know, fast and can create problems. So just offensively, this team is very, very talented. But the biggest takeaway is Joel Tinney is nasty. He is a nasty lacrosse player. He makes that team so much better. He is so dangerous. Great dodger, great shooter, competitive for days. He makes that team so much better.
A lot has been said, and his hidden ball trick goal got a lot of action and replays on social media, SportsCenter. That shot that he took was incredible. I mean, again, with an open net and no one on the field, that's a, you know, you hit that 80% of the time, you know, in practice. But that was in a tie game. Home opener, you haven't played in a year, with a defender 8 yards in front of you and a goalie standing in goal. It was just a spectacular shot, and I don't think that is the accuracy, the velocity on it, and the guts to shoot from there. That was not, I don't think a lot's been said just about that alone.
Well, the goalie unfortunately was staring down John Crawley, so he was he didn't even react when the ball hit the net. That's how good of a fake it was. But you're right. That was a, 25, 30-yard rope.
Yeah.
I mean, just a bullet and great placement. And I think what makes it that much more impressive, the coaching staff for Hopkins after the game said that was nothing planned. That was just all improvised between Tinney and Crawley. That was not, hey, let's run, you know, the wagging dog or, you know, some other name of the play. It was Tinney and Crawley just saw an opportunity to run it. And credit John Crawley for selling it, because half the defense for Navy was staring down number 44 in white. And then only two guys, I think, for Navy knew that Tinney was the one that actually had the ball. And, you know, I think Ricky Soule after the game said, we have to do a better job of identifying where the ball was. And I don't disagree with that. But there comes a time, too, where you just have to tip your cap to the deception that was in there and just say, you know what, that they just faked our shorts off. Paul Carcaterra said it, who did the game. He's like, I didn't know where the ball was. I had no clue who had the ball. They made a great play, and it worked out, and it was worthy of all the buzz afterward on SportsCenter and Barstool and all the other outlets that highlighted it.
A guy on the Blue Jays that I really enjoy watching is Patrick Frazier. Whether it's in an extra man situation or just coming down on the alley, laser shot, and always fun to watch. Dix, two guys we haven't mentioned are the Blue Jays' leading scorers, Shaq Stanwyck and Wilkins Dismuk. Shaq has 4 goals, 5 assists, and Dismuk has 6 goals and through the first 2 games. So the attack, they lost Ryan Brown, which is a huge loss, but they're getting set up pretty well by that midfield.
They are, because the midfield is able to open things up, create slides. Stanwyck, I thought, was much more effective against UMBC than he was against Navy. Scored a couple of goals, took advantage of short stick matchups. He's a smart guy, and he's a leader. You know, Wilkins Dismuk is the Rodney Dangerfield of Johns Hopkins, if not of all of college lacrosse. He gets no respect. He gets no recognition. Started 2 years ago and was pumping in 2-3 goals a game, and his reward was being replaced by Shaq Stanwyck in the starting lineup. He's effective, and he's just he's become more of a leader for Johns Hopkins this year, and he's having a terrific start to the season. You mentioned Frazier. He's always had that extra man, left-handed cannon. With time and space, he's going to make you pay. But what I really like about his game is he's developed more of a shot on the run. He stuck one against Navy that was a thing of beauty, going down the right alley, and then he was able to hide his stick and just put a BB past the Navy goaltender into the upper 90. So again, this team is dangerous. I mean, I'm not trying to say Hopkins' attack isn't talented, isn't good, but they really don't have anybody that can run by another guy. Forrey Smith has shown that ability. Cole Williams blew by a short stick matchup the other day against UMBC, but by and large, you know, it's a feeding attack, close in finishing kind of unit now with Ryan Brown gone and him shooting from, you know, the Glen Burnie zip code half the time. But the midfield, it really has opened things up a lot for this team, and they've been a lot of fun to watch.
Moving on, Dix, a huge game for on the front range out in Colorado. Number 3 Denver grounds number 17 Air Force 14-6. No surprises, really. Connor Canizaro with 4 goals and 2 assists. Ethan Walker had a really good game in his debut, 3 goals, 2 assists. And Denver wins 16 of 22 faceoffs through the game. So not a lot of surprises, but the new number 1 Denver Pioneers in this week's Cascade Media Poll really proved that they are a force to be reckoned with this season.
And this is an Air Force team coming off a huge win against Duke on the road, so you knew the Falcons, even without that win over Duke, was going to have the Pioneers' attention. I mean, how about the weather, though, this past weekend? 55 degrees in Denver for this game this past weekend. You had temperatures pushing 50, low 50s in Baltimore for the Loyola Johns Hopkins contests, and then, you know, Marine Corps Stadium not too far away down in Annapolis for Maryland and Navy. So, you know, tip of the cap to Mother Nature for giving us some decent lacrosse weather here in February. But, you know, Denver's a team. Connor Canizaro, as you mentioned, 4-2. Ethan Walker, just a really good-looking freshman, another Culver product. We just talked about Matt Neufeldt. We talked about Joel Tinney. You know, Ethan Walker is a Culver product, and he's had a tremendous start to his season with the 5-point effort. And then you get what you expect out of Trevor Baptiste. What I liked about this game is Air Force is a talented offensive ball club, and it looks like this Denver defense is much improved from a year ago. It was something in replacing Ryan LaPlante with Alex Reddy. I thought that was, you know, I thought Reddy struggled last season. Mike Reese gone as the long stick midfielder that created a lot of transition for Denver graduated. But I think when you look at this defense now, Christian Bergdorf is a first team All-American. But then you have guys like Dylan Johnson and Dylan Gaines, and Sean Mayle is a playmaker, a guy who has been dynamic so far in 2017. He looked great against Hopkins in a scrimmage. He looked terrific this past weekend against Air Force. And this is a team that hasn't, you know, they lost Zach Miller, and they also have not had the services of Tyler Pace, you know, in the preseason here, dealing with a couple of injuries. So this is a nice win for Bill Tierney and his Pioneers to really, in a year where they were preseason number one, a lot of folks, myself included, bumped them out of the number one position when you see Zach Miller's not playing, and they're serving notice that they're back. Again, only one game, only one result, but really nice win over a quality Air Force team, dominant at home, you know, by eight goals.
Dix, let's move on to another segment where we look at your top five teams in the country. Now, this week in the new Maverick media poll on InsideLacrosse.com is up, and in reverse order, it's Hopkins coming in at number 5, Notre Dame at number 4, Maryland at 3, UNC at number 2, and the new number 1 is the Denver Pioneers. How do you see, like, your top 5? Break it down for me.
It's so early, but I've got Yale at number 5, and I know they haven't played a game, but neither is Notre Dame. And I feel like Notre Dame is going to be a little bit down this year. And I've said this before, Notre Dame could be the North Carolina of 2016. You know, last year was supposed to be the Irish's year with Landis on defense, Kavanaugh on attack, Perkovic in the midfield, and it didn't work out for them. You know, you rewind to the 2015 Carolina team with Sankey and Bitter, and they were expected to get the championship weekend, didn't. Last year, Notre Dame was that team. So, you know, Notre Dame's probably like right around that 6-7 area for me. But I've got Yale at 5, Hopkins at 4, Denver is my number 3, North Carolina number 2, and they had a kind of a ding-dong game against Furman. What I mean by that is, you know, not great, not terrible, just kind of, you know, gritted that thing out. And I got Maryland as number 1. I said a couple weeks ago that Maryland was my number 1 in the preseason. They remain my number 1. And I thought that their win over Maryland was impressive. Over Navy was impressive. So that's my top 5. Yale, Hopkins, Denver, Carolina, Maryland is in the top spot.
All right, moving on to another segment. This is the Epic Inside Lacrosse Committed Academy Freshman of the Week, Dix. It's a new segment sponsored by Epic Isle Committed Academy, which is July 28th to 30th for committed Division I men's players. The women's version of it is July 7th and 9th this summer. And it's for 2017s, 2018s. You play in your conference or represent your school and your league in the 10 Division I men's conferences. And our freshman of the week this week is Joey Manone from Duke University. It had a good week. He's a freshman attackman. Had 2 goals, 2 assists in Friday's 10-5 win over High Point, and followed that up with 2 goals against Cleveland State and a 22-7 win on Sunday. Now, here's the big question. Inside our offices, he's been known as Joey Manone for a long time. He's one of our Duke was our top class this year. He played in the Community Academy with a few of his teammates. But now I'm hearing on the broadcast of the game, it's Manone. So there's a little bit of controversy, and we got to get to the bottom of this and find out exactly what his name is. We may have been saying it wrong for a while.
There's 3 things to consider when you have a name. What the coach calls him, what the SID calls him, and what his mom calls him.
And so, there's only one that matters, really.
And there's
right?
only one that matters. So ask Mrs. Manone, Mrs. Manone. Either way, this guy has a name for a boy band. Joey Manone. Hey, Joey,
he's
get
got
together.
A bit of the look, too.
Get together with 3 or 4 of your teammates or classmates or guys from back home, and you guys can be a boy band. Joey Manone, you kidding me? Joey Manone. Joey Manone.
I think
Joey
there was
Manone.
A Joey Fatone that was in a boy band.
That's what I'm
I
talking
think that's
about.
Stuck in your head.
That's either way. It's this guy's name has boy band written all over
it. I think that
it.
Should be our give and go sometime. Be your three favorite boy bands of
I,
all time.
I will tell you right now, my kids laugh at me. My wife laughs at me. I'm big on boy bands. I like boy bands. I like the music so a lot of time. Hey, man, look at Justin Timberlake. Don't hate on the boy band. This is not an insult to Joey. By any stretch of the imagination, but that is a boy band name.
It's an absolute compliment. It's an absolute compliment. Well, he is our Epic IL Committed Academy Freshman of the Week. Dix, another thing that we're going to try to do each week is look at a pressing issue within the sport of lacrosse and sort of tackle an issue and what sort of be a deep dive into it. I'd like to start this week with the first topic being the sort of the early creep to the season and the sayonara to midweek games. Christian Sweezy, one of our favorites here at Inside Lacrosse, had a good article last week about this exact topic, sort of lamenting about how there used to be a lot more midweek games scheduled. And he gives some different reasons why this is happening. But as an example, he says, in the NCAA tournament era, Navy Johns Hopkins regular season games have moved from May... From 1972 to 1982, Hopkins and Navy played in May. Back to April, which was from 83 to 2014, Hopkins and Navy would play in April. We witnessed a lot of these games, you and I, Dix. You played in a bunch of them. There'd be, you know, sometimes Navy would do it before their spring football game, and there'd be 15,000 people there for some of those games, 10,000 fans at Navy Marine Corps. Hopkins would play Navy, get 8,000 people at Homewood Field on a nice sunny day. In March, it kicked back last year, 2 years ago in 2015, and now in February they're playing the last 2 years. And then he says, Christian goes on to say that another scheduling trend was also displayed last Tuesday at Homewood Field, the Blue Jays' only midweek game of the year. And he says that other programs, such as North Carolina, only has one scheduled midweek game, March 13th against Richmond. And in 2015, the Tar Heels played three midweek games, and in 2011, they played four. This season, Denver has no midweek games. Maryland's gone from four midweek games in 1981 to three in 2015 to one this season. And the trend's clearly moving away from it. Now, a lot of it has to do with conference realignments, schools like Hopkins joining a league affiliate, teams like Syracuse joining the ACC a few years ago. And the conferences dictating what the schedules would be, saying, hey, we're going to have our games on Saturdays in April leading up to a conference tournament. And those, the importance and the seriousness, more or less, of those games as it relates to your NCAA tournament status became bigger and bigger. Is this something that has gone away for good, Dix, the midweek game?
There's a lot of, I mean, we're in February, and there's going to be a lot of entertaining Tuesday games coming up. You know, Tuesday is typically that you play on a Saturday, and if you want a midweek game, you put it on that Tuesday so you have enough time to prepare and get ready for your weekend contest. This is the way it's kind of gone. And conference play, teams join conferences, Hopkins, primary example, joining the Big Ten, Air Force, in the Southern Conference. You join a conference so that you have that mulligan, if you will, to get into the NCAA via the automatic qualifier. So conference play has become very, very important within college lacrosse. Now, the ACC lost their AQ once Maryland moved to the Big Ten. They don't have the automatic qualifier anymore, so they've got to play their way in. So it's a little different equation in the ACC, but every other conference plays via the automatic qualifier. And, you know, it's just incredibly important for all of these teams. And then you get into the coaching aspect. Okay, do I want my team playing on a Tuesday when, let's just take Maryland, for instance, they've got Penn State on a Saturday, then the following weekend they've got Michigan. Do they want to be playing a Navy or a Loyola or a Virginia in the middle of the week? And the answer is no. Typically, Maryland is going to get, if they play a midweek game, and this is not just exclusive to Maryland, this could be any team, they're going to get a team in there that's probably not the same caliber, you know, during conference play. But I'm kind of even defeating the purpose and getting ahead of myself. I see this staying the way it is. And fans can lament it, and we as lacrosse folks can lament it, but this is kind of the way it's gone because there's so much emphasis and so much importance placed on those conference games.
And one thing to note about the conference games, unlike in basketball, where we're very familiar with the beginning of March Madness really starts with the conference tournaments, and every team makes that. It's a tournament where you're seeded from, you know, in the ACC basketball, for instance, it's 1 through 15. The top four teams in the standings at the end of the regular season get byes, and they get to sit out while the other 11 teams sort of play their way into it. In lacrosse, that's not the case. A lot of the conference tournaments, it's may just be the top four seed teams in the league standings out of a 8 or 10 team league. So the conference play, those games, those home and away games in that they're scheduled on a weekend, and the preparation time that's put into those, letting guys rest, letting guys get healthy, and then prepping for the game, watching film, scouting reports, becomes even more important in lacrosse because you have to make your conference tournament in order to be able to qualify for that that AQ. We've mentioned that as we've talked about some of the Big Ten teams, for example, in our first couple of podcasts, where it's really important to finish in that top four so that you make the conference tournament.
And when you look at even college basketball, which might not be the greatest example because typically conferences have 8, 10, 12 or more teams that are competing. Lacrosse, the max for the most part, your average is a six-team conference. Big Ten right now is six teams. Colonial Athletic Association, what are they? They're six, right? I'd have to do the math or look that up. Patriot is more than six. But it's right around like six, seven teams. And it's difficult at the end of the day when you have such importance placed on those conference games. But college basketball, teams will play their non-conference schedule, and then once they get into conference play, they really don't stray from outside their conference all that much. I mean, yeah, I know you're a huge Duke fan. Let's use Duke basketball as an example. Yeah. They play, what, a 10-12 game?
So there's 15 teams in the ACC basketball.
Right.
And there's
five for lacrosse.
So not everybody can play at the same time. So on a weekend, because there's an odd number of teams, you're right. Usually one team out. So that team that has the bye week, so to speak, can choose to play a game, non-conference game, or rest. So it sort of depends when your scheduling is, and some teams choose to play or not play. You know, Duke has, on occasion, more than that, but played a non-conference game against Georgetown or St. John's a lot, and it's usually right around now. Like, they'll have a Sunday game before the Super Bowl against St. John's or Georgetown or somebody like that.
Yeah, so
but that's an example of which.
Yeah, sure, but that's why I asked.
You're right. It's very rare, though. It's very rare.
Yeah, when they get into conference play, and again, this is, would you say 15 teams are in the ACC? And I know they're broken into divisions, right? Is it the Coastal Division?
Non-basketball.
Yeah,
there's the Coastal, and then there's
the Atlantic?
That might be right.
I have no clue.
That's for football, though. Standings in football, and then the teams that win each of their standings make it to the conference.
I guess what I'm trying to say is ACC teams, you don't play each other twice from top to bottom, right? You
have it's
like a linear division or something like that. You know, no, seven here, seven there.
We're getting into a little too much basketball stuff, but
right.
The way the ACC does it is you have sort of a traditional partner that you always play home and home, and Duke,
Carolina and Duke,
yeah. And a couple other ones that they're doing, and then they rotate other ones.
I see. Play
home and away, and then you have some teams that you play only once a year. It could be on the road, like Duke has a big game coming up on Wednesday at Virginia. This is in basketball. We're just using this to make an example.
Yeah,
but they only play Virginia once, and they have to go on the road to do that because of this unbalanced schedule. Where in lacrosse, it's pretty much you're playing each team.
And that's the point I was getting at. You play one team one time. You know, in the ACC, Virginia will play Carolina once, Duke once, Notre Dame once, Syracuse once, and that's it. That's your ACC schedule. And we've seen through the years, Virginia, what are they, 1-18 in the last handful of years in the ACC? Those ACC games become so important to them use Virginia in the ACC. We could use Georgetown
in the
Big East. Yeah. We can use Hofstra in the Colonial Athletic Association.
Yeah, pick your team.
Those games are so critical, and the coaches want their kids as fresh as possible. Now, you could have the converse. If you're on a roll, you're Hofstra and you've won four in a row, then you hit your conference play and you knock off Drexel and then you knock off Fairfield and you've got Towson staring you in the face, maybe you would want to have a midweek game to keep that momentum going as opposed to having practice. But that's not the way it is. I think the coaches look at it more of the vantage point of we got to get our kids ready for these conference games. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, you may not know this, but I remember the last time Hopkins played Navy in April was at Navy Marine Corps Stadium, and it's going on 3-4 years ago. It was like 40 freaking degrees.
Oh, it was really cold.
It was 40 degrees. So I understand traditionally, if you get Hopkins in Navy, and when I played at Hopkins, it was either a homecoming game or we were at Navy, and we got great crowds, great weather, but you do run the risk of having bad weather, and people will stay home, and you're not going to get... So it is what it is. Do I wish we could have Hopkins Navy and just using those two teams, that rivalry as an example? Do I wish we could have them in April on a 70-degree day with 8,000-10,000 people in the stands? Sure. But the last time these two teams played in April, it was freezing, and there was hardly anybody at the game. And I don't even think the game was televised, to be honest with you. I can't remember because I was at the game. I didn't watch it. But sometimes you're at the mercy of Mother Nature, too.
So getting back to Sweezy's article, which I encourage you to read. It's on InsideLacrosse.com from maybe the middle of last week after the Navy-Hopkins game. But he wraps it up in a way that I really didn't see it coming this way. But he says that if coaches who love control, and one of the I think they like to get into a routine during the season, too,
sure.
Which is sort of like, hey, Monday we watch film, we lift weights, and we put in a scouting report, and Tuesday we do this, and then we sort of work our way up to game day on Saturday. I think coaches really enjoy that. He's like, well, why do we play the championship weekend, the most important weekend of the season, and we play one game, the semifinals on Saturday, and then come back with no rest, no preparation, no time to let some bumps and bruises heal up and play the championship game on Monday? Why are we doing that?
I think it's a great point. But, again, and I don't want to go into the weeds with college basketball again, but college basketball has the same model. And, you look at conference play right now. Let's take the Pac-12, and Oregon plays UCLA on Saturday. They're not playing Arizona State on Monday.
Actually, that is how it works.
Is it? No, it might be. Yeah.
That's a bad example. So what they do in the Pac-12, just to clarify.
I picked the wrong conference, didn't I?
So they have travel partners.
Okay.
So like the Oregon teams. So this past weekend on Thursday night, Oregon played UCLA in Los Angeles, while Oregon State was playing over at USC. Shout out to USC coach Andy Enfield, Johns Hopkins grad and one of our friends. And then on Saturday or Sunday, depends on when TV does, they flip-flop and like Oregon State goes and plays.
You can tell how much college basketball I watch, especially Pac-12. I watch ACC. I watch
one of my
Big
friends
Ten.
is a head
of course,
coach
no,
of a team.
Okay, let's use a different example then, Big Ten.
Yeah.
Maryland played Ohio State on Saturday. I believe they play Northwestern today, Tuesday, or tomorrow, Wednesday. Rarely do you see a Saturday, Monday.
Okay,
I got a good example. Look at me. So that's what I'm looking, But their Final Four is Saturday semifinals, championship Monday night. Look, there's been a lot of discussion around championship weekend and ways to improve attendance. I mean, last year is a bad example because last year was a tremendous championship weekend in terms of the results and the play on the field. But years previous have been, the Monday championship has been a little humdrum because one team looks really tired. But that's kind of the nature of the beast. But that notwithstanding, I think it's a great point that Christian makes. But again, that is for all the marbles. Like, that's for the championship. And would those coaches prefer to have a week in between the semifinals and the championship? Probably. And I think that's being explored right now by the NCAA as well as coaches and administrators and that kind of thing. But I guess coaches feel like in order to get there, they've got to keep the model the way it is. And that is conference games a week apart or, 6 days apart, 8 days apart, however you want to look at it. But they don't want those. They just don't want those midweek games in the middle. And it's a shame. I do think it's a shame. But we do get treated to some good midweek games in February and March. And as a fan, it can be a little bit neat. Like, okay, once that calendar flips to April, you're like, hey, it's conference play.
Yeah.
We're going to see, the teams that we compete against as Big East members, as CAA members, as America East members, So we know, you're an Albany fan. You're going to get a steady diet of Stony Brook and Vermont and Binghamton and UMBC. I think there's a little bit of excitement in that as well.
And just to argue the other side of it, why you would want to play those midweek games, I think a good is if you are playing, a nationally ranked team on a Saturday, maybe on Wednesday you play, a team that's maybe not as competitive as another nationally ranked game, and you work on your depth. You let some of your younger guys get some time. You work on a couple of things. You work out some of the kinks. So there's pluses and minuses to it, but we do see it.
And I agree 100% with your pluses. Let me give you a big minus. A team that's in that situation feels like they have everything to lose and nothing to gain by that midweek game. So that, I think, is another mindset that coaches may take on.
Awesome. Thanks, Dix. That's our first deep dive topic. We'll try to get into something like that each week. Let's take some listener questions. So each week we'll solicit some questions on Twitter, things that you saw over the weekend that you liked, didn't like, have questions about. Dix, here's one from @lax904. You know, Mark is not only a television commentator for the Big Ten Network, ESPN, but he's also, I don't know if a lot of people know this, a very good official. Does college games, high school games. How are referees instructed to call the stall warning to ensure consistency through games and the season?
Okay, first and foremost, I have to disclose that being a NILOA official, the National Intercollegiate Lacrosse Officials Association, we do have a social media / media policy that prohibits all of its members, me included, from discussing games that we officiate and games that others officiate. With that being said, I can answer this question because I can read directly from the rule book. If you look in the points of emphasis, and this is a great question, by the way. It is a great question. If you look in the points of emphasis in the rule book for 2017-2018, because we're in a two-year rule cycle, and I'm looking at pages 10 and 11, it looks like, stalling, warning, shot clock. And I'm going to read directly from the rule book. The committee will continue to strive for consistency when implementing the shot clock procedure. Game officials have improved in this area, and the committee will continue to focus on the key elements of stalling. Officials' judgment will always be part of the implementation of this rule, but the goal is for national consistency. The key principle in applying the stalling rules deal with whether or not the team in possession is actively attempting to score a goal. So that's the rule book. Now, Mark Dixon.
That's hard to tell, though, sometimes.
Right. And they've added language. The rules committee added language. Indicators that a team is not stalling include, and this is directly out of the rule book, one, putting the ball at risk to find a scoring opportunity. Example, a pass in front of the goal. Two, continuing to run offense, screening, cutting, etc. And three, attempting legitimate shots that miss the cage. Helpful to a certain extent, but also subjective. But if you see a guy trying to hit a cutter on a feed and it's not handled and the offense is able to get the ball back, do you put a stall on him? Look, they're trying to score. They're putting the ball at risk. I think one thing that needs to be pointed out, oftentimes people will say, you have to reward the defense. The defense is playing. There's nothing in the rule book that says a defense gets rewarded for playing good defense, therefore gets a shot clock. There's nothing in the rule book that says that. However, it remains a bone of contention. It's a very subjective, procedure. But again, the rules committee, in the rule book, what I just read, that passage under stalling warning / shot clock under points of emphasis, that is how officials are determining, based on that guidance and based on their knowledge and training, that's how they're determining whether or not to put a shot clock on.
Next question is from at Coach Moreland, PA. He wants to know why isn't Tyler Pace playing? He's referencing a player at Denver University. Our indications from our people in Denver are saying that he's just battling a few nagging injuries, and when he is healed up, he will be back in the lineup for the Pioneers. Dix, you want to look at some of these?
Yeah.
LaxFacts 001 sent in a few. Any of these that you like?
Let's see.
He wants to know, like,
what should Brown really be ranked? How overrated is Fairfield, and why is Ohio State getting so much love? I don't know where Brown should really be ranked because they haven't played a game yet.
And they lost a lot.
And they lost a lot of guys.
We need to see what they can do.
Yeah, they return a ton of guys. How overrated is Fairfield? I don't think Fairfield really is that overrated. They lost to a very good Richmond team this past weekend. And we're 2 weeks into the season, really,
Sometimes 1.0. There's still some teams that haven't played yet.
And why is Ohio State getting so much love? They're 2-0. I don't particularly see Ohio State.
Well, I think it goes, Quint and Terry have talked about the Buckeyes a little bit on their podcast, and one of the things Quint said on Friday, he also said in his top 20 this week that they've won two games, and based on their schedule the next few, it's likely that they would be favored in each of their next five games or six games, so maybe that's what he's referencing. It's February.
Sure.
It's Valentine's Day. There's still a ton of lacrosse to be played. Let's not get too excited or worried about any particular outcome so far.
I can tell you, looking at Ohio State, two things that look positive to me. They had a lot of injuries last year. and a lot of one-goal losses. And the guys that were injured last year are healthy and playing and contributing. And the offense looks much more dynamic so far here in the early season. I know they're only two games in, but those are two reasons to be optimistic if you're an Ohio State fan.
Another one that's interesting to me, just because I grew up in Newark, Delaware, is, at LaxFacts 001 is also interested in speculating way ahead of time who might be in the mix for the Delaware coaching job when Coach Schillinglaw steps down after 39 seasons on the sidelines. Byron Collins is assistant coach there, very well thought of, and a good up-and-coming assistant coach. He'd certainly be a candidate for the job. There's a few other head coaches throughout Division One who have some Delaware ties.
Well, you have Dave Metzbauer, offensive mm-hmm. coordinator at North Carolina, is a Delaware graduate. Would he be interested in taking the reins? Chris Collins is an assistant at Drexel, played goaltender for Coach Schillinglaw a few years back. I think this job is going to attract a lot of interest. I think when you look at this program, the facilities are terrific. That's a FCS football school. Is that?
Yeah.
The old Division I AA.
Delaware Stadium, which holds about 20,000 people.
Right.
Now has a field turf field in it. And then you have the arena, the field right outside that is meant for field hockey and lacrosse. That is a beautiful little facility. There's an indoor facility where the old field house is there. And it's centrally located between some of lacrosse's biggest
hotbeds. I was just going to say, geography.
Right off of I-95.
Right off of 95, so you've got easy access from the Baltimore corridor. So the DMV, I guess we should call it, the D.C., Maryland, Virginia, neck of the woods. Then you go further north, the Philly, New York, New England.
Always have been a lot of New Jersey and Long Island kids at the University of Delaware. And the school, again, I'm a little biased. My mom and my dad went there. My sister went there. My brother-in-law went there.
You couldn't get in.
My brother went there. My sister-in-law went there. So I have a lot of fit. My dad is in their Athletic Hall of Fame there. He's a football and former track coach there.
Whoa.
A friend of Coach Schillinglaw's. So I have a lot of history with the Blue Hens. Grew up, walking around in the campus and on the sidelines and stuff like that. It's a place that's near and dear to me. I honestly think, Dix, that you're right. I think that this should be a job a lot of people are interested in. I think Delaware can win the national championship in lacrosse. I think they have, with the right coach and some time, I think that things are in place. It fits an academic profile. There's some really good programs there, yet it's not the most intense school to get into. So you can appeal to the top student athletes, yet also maybe sneak a kid in or two here and there. It's a fun school. It's a nice college town, and the proximity to the hotbeds, and right off of 95. And I think that a coach can win a national championship at Delaware.
Bold statement.
Boom. Said
look
it.
Look at this. Dan Flynn.
Drop the mic. You got to finish this podcast on your own.
Okay.
I'm out.
That's Dan Flynn, everybody, predicting a national championship for the Delaware Blue Hens in lacrosse in the next 5 years, 7 years?
I'll give you an example of what can happen there. And this is a little bit of extreme, but Delaware just won the field hockey national championship. They beat, I think, North Carolina or somebody like that to win it. And they just got the right coach. And the guy said, again, my dad's down there all the time. He told my dad this. He said, why did you take this job? It's a guy from Holland. Something. He got a couple of Dutch girls to come here. And
Johan Cruyff?
I wish I could tell you the guy's name. But Delaware's had a good field hockey program, but in the CAA, they've never been this good where they won the national championship. And it was a shock to me as a lifelong fan of the program. He took a 2-inch circle around Newark, Delaware, and said most of the field hockey players, top high school players, or kids, youth players in the country are coming from this 2-inch radius around Newark, Delaware. He said, why wouldn't I take this job?
2 inches on a map, right?
On a map, yeah.
Just make sure.
He got right out to 896, right outside on Main Street. He barely got
well,
very far.
That is...
But it's similar in lacrosse.
But that's... So right there, you just gave the blueprint for Miami football back under the days of Howard Schnellenberger. He basically said, if we win the state of Miami, we will win multiple national championships. And they started getting kids from that Miami-Dade area. It sounds a lot like what Delaware field hockey did. Instead of those athletes in that radius that you just described heading to a North Carolina or a Maryland or wherever else the field hockey powers are, he's keeping them at Delaware. Now he's got a national championship.
Yeah, national championship, which is...
That's impressive.
It is impressive. All right, Dix.
One more question.
Yeah,
we
got to
get... Was it Coach Beaudoin? Beaudoin? Sorry if we're butchering the name, but he asked... Who has the advantage? Team with the first game in week two against a team and played week one. Is game film a huge advantage either way? I really don't see.
There's a lot of ways to answer this question.
Yeah. You go first.
So it my take is it depends on who you're playing in week one and week two and whether you're the team sitting out or not. It depends, you know, if your team is healthy or that you need that extra time. But there's a lot of factors that weigh into this. In general, I would say that it's always better to have a game under your belt. Approaching that second week game, catching a team that hasn't played before, especially if the weather is bad, if it's cold, you've got that one game where you've run through the paces. Your freshmen know what your game day routine is. You're not nervous, and it also depends whether the game's on the road or at home. You know, what kind of routine you're in, and you know where it could be and things like that.
Yeah, I would agree with all those points that you made. And game film is a huge help. If you're preparing for a team that hasn't played since last May, and if you get an opportunity to, and you know, the gentleman's agreement, nobody films fall ball, nobody films preseason scrimmages. So you know, I'm not quite sure what I don't think they share that information either. But seeing a team fresh versus, you know, however many months ago was that? May is the fifth month of the year. We're in February. So we're talking, 9 months ago? You know, you're looking 9 months ago. That could be a huge help. So I do think game film can be an advantage. But I, you know, these guys play scrimmages, and the scrimmages are treated just like games with the same type of intensity, pace. Maybe not the atmosphere, because maybe not as many fans that might come to a game, come to a scrimmage. So I don't see it to be a huge advantage, but I mean, you made several good points as to why it could be.
Yeah, another. Comparing similar type of sports in terms of like a weekly preparation, lots of guys on the team. Dix and I were talking about this earlier. I use the Ivy League football sort of analogy that they often the Ivy League plays only 10 games. A lot of the other FCS schools play 12 regular season games. And the Ivy League has no bye week, usually. So it's like you start, your first home game is the second or third weekend, or sometimes the fourth weekend, Saturday in September, while you play a Patriot League school that may have two or three games under their belt. And it's a big advantage for those schools that have played a few games. And football is sort of a, you have specialty units like a man up, man down. Like that's what the first game, getting that under your belt, is really helpful for. All those specialty situations, you know, in football, it's your special teams units and things like that. So I would agree that I think getting a game under your belt is an advantage.
Good stuff.
All right, Dix, time for our favorite segment, which we're going to call Give and Go.
Give and Go. All right.
All right. So
I
give you a topic. And then I let you go on it.
Oh, all right.
All right? I'll give you a couple minutes to think about it, and I'll give you mine.
Okay.
So today is Valentine's Day.
Right.
I hope you're doing something special for the missus. And
don't forget about your mom, too.
Never forget about the most important
moms.
Ladies in
sure.
your life. So here's our top three. I'll give you three things. Favorite, romantic food restaurant ideas. Now, you don't have to name specific restaurants, but you know, romantic dinners, like setting, situation. So I'll give you my three. First, I'm going to go with a good seafood dinner. You know, like go out to a restaurant, get some crab cakes, or around here, you know, get a good seafood dinner.
Okay.
Like a McCormick and Schmick's or someplace like that.
You're not talking Red Lobster or
Oh, God. I'll tell you a great Red Lobster story when we get off there.
Arthur Treacher's.
Fish and chips, man. That's the best. second would be like a nice home-cooked meal, you know, a good home-cooked meal if you do it right. And then my third is, and my number one really, is the Italian restaurant. Can't beat it. Food's the best. Nice little intimate setting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, might even get like the, you know, we have Little Italy here in Baltimore. There's a lot of
get
options.
The violin player.
Places. Yeah, you might even get like the Italian, old Italian guy.
Vincenzo.
Sends you, you know, a carafe of wine because he sees this young couple.
Then he just poured out of a box. It charges you $55 for it, but why not?
Squeeze the last bit out of a box. But, yeah, I would go with Italian restaurant as sort of my top choice for that romantic. What do you do?
Oh, man. All right. So, you know, that's a great question. So I would have to agree with Italian, especially before my wife and I had kids. And even when they were younger, we could actually, like, get out of the house to do something, you know, not running them to a practice or an event or something like that. We did spend a good amount of time in Little Italy, you know, for Valentine's Day. So I would agree with the Italian.
Got a favorite spot over there?
I like DeMimo.
That's the best.
Enjoy DeMimo.
That's the right answer.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Are they a sponsor now? Okay. I'll take the veal chop to go. Thank you. You know, and I'm not talking like, you know, I'm not a big pasta guy. I'm not a big Italian food guy. Quite honestly.
What's not to like?
I don't know. I just...
They have everything.
They do, but I'm just not a... I'm not a big pasta guy. I've never been a big spaghetti and meatball guy or lasagna. Like every,
first of all, if you're going to a Little Italy and you're getting spaghetti and meatballs, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, true. True.
But you get a steak, you can get a chop, you get...
yeah, but that... I mean...
get seafood.
Yeah, but that's like going to Ruth's Chris and getting lasagna, you know? You don't go to an Italian restaurant to get a steak. Right? Am I wrong or am I crazy? Like, I don't go to Ruth's Chris or I don't go to Fleming's or, you know, name any other steakhouse, Capital Grill, to get spaghetti.
Sizzler.
Or to get
Golden Corral.
Oh, the Sizzler. Are you kidding me? The Ponderosa back in the day. I remember the greatest thing was
salad bar.
They had the salad bar, but then they also had like a dessert bar, and it was just like a big, like, tub of pudding.
Or like those little Jello squares with like a top of whipped cream on it. Not eating this.
And that,
this
no, is supposed to be... that's the thing. We did eat it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the whipped cream, like, the thing could be there for 17 hours and the whipped cream hasn't moved. And you're like, not
do
even.
Do you remember the horn and horn smorgasbord? Do you remember those around here?
Yes.
I just remember going there as a kid and they had the soft serve ice cream machine or whatever that you could get. I was like, I can get this myself.
Horn and horn smorgasbord. I remember that. And I think
dad
you might as well,
have,
instead of getting the ham, you might as well just open up the salt shaker, just drink directly out of that. It was like so much.
You like to drink? I'll take the water that the green beans are in.
Yeah. I thought that was a great pull with Ponderosa, but the horn smorgasbord.
My dad loved that place.
Oh, that's crazy.
Because it was all you can eat for $11.99.
Oh,
my dad would
take teenagers there. I remember coming back from Jersey with my buddy Jason Pressman, who I played lacrosse with.
Press.
With Press. And his beast. And his brother, his younger brother, is Hoagie. His nickname is Hoagie. And there was two other guys that we were with, and we went to the Ponderosa. I think they threw us out. Was it Ponderosa or Sizzler? It was one of them. And this was like 20 years ago. But yeah, I think they
ate too much. Like Homer Simpson.
Well, all you can eat is like all you can eat, right?
Remember when Homer Simpson gets thrown out of the seafood place?
And he ate like the wax figurine or something like that. Like, I don't think we were that bad. We were just hanging out, but they were like getting kind of angry and like threw us out of the. It was either a Ponderosa or a Sizzler. I can't remember which one it was. But it was fun. Anyway, so all right, Italian would be number one.
Okay.
Try to think what number two and three would be. I mean, I love a steakhouse, a great steakhouse. You can't beat it. And actually, you know, when my wife and I are able to get out to dinner, well, typically, you know, we live on the west side of town in that Howard County area.
I've heard of it.
We love going to the Iron Bridge Wine Company.
That's a good spot.
That's a great spot. Yeah. We enjoy. My wife really enjoys a restaurant called Lee Lynn's out that way.
Love Lee Lynn's.
You know, so it's like we typically just go to like quiet spots just to, you know, grab some dinner, have a glass of wine or split a bottle of wine or something like that. So a good, like a good steakhouse, you know, obviously I'm a big fan of all your Ruth's Chris, Capital Grills, Fleming's.
What do you get on the side with your steak?
I love broccoli.
Me too.
Broccoli is the vegetable, is the Mark Dixon go-to vegetable.
Okay.
And you can't beat good asparagus either. Asparagus is tremendous.
You know what I've been doing lately? Like oven roasted Brussels sprouts, which I refuse to eat for the first all of my life.
Let me tell you, Brussels sprouts when done correctly, yeah, like a little white wine, some shallot, you know, I am not into the charred Brussels sprout. Like to the point where it's like, I don't mind that little burnt smoky flavor, but sometimes it's like
that.
Charred.
Because some of them are bigger than the other ones.
It looks like it was in a campfire for 2 hours.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
You know, but yeah. I'll never forget Owen, my 12-year-old, a few years ago. He refuses to eat, to this day, won't eat Brussels sprouts. And I'll never forget one night, I was like, look, I think he had 2 Brussels sprouts on his plate. You eat your Brussels sprouts, we're going to Cold Stone afterward. Ooh. Cold Stone is like the call to get your kids to eat their vegetables. He still would not eat those.
Wow.
To this
just
day,
refusal.
My older son, Matt.
Did he say, good day to you, sir?
Torments him. Oh, like the time we could go to Cold Stone because you eat your Brussels sprouts. Oh, so that's always fun. Last but not least, I'll go with the home cooked meal. I'm allergic to shellfish, so I really can't go to a great seafood restaurant unless I'm looking to get a fish. And I love like tuna steak and things of that nature. But I'm not like a huge fish guy.
Okay.
So
tough growing up around these parts.
Well, I didn't figure it out till I got to high school, and then it, you know, I kind of pushed my luck a little bit in college, and then right thereafter. But then I had a then I got really brazen and ate a crab cake and ended up in the ER. So that was the end of my crab cake days, you know. Yeah, and I'll never forget the ER doc looking at me being like, so you know you're allergic. I'm like, oh, yeah, but I thought, and he just, the look of disgust on the guy's face, I think he just wanted to punch me right in the head. So I love the kids especially, like, you know, if you're coming home from, you know, a game or something like that, you've been out all day and you want to grab something, you know, carry out and eating at home is great. So that,
talking about romantic Valentine's Day, doing some carry out with the kids.
Listen, with 14 and 12-year-old, you know, romantic at home, anything, let alone Valentine's Day dinner, is just not. Just wait until your kids get a little older and you'll see what I'm talking about.
They already ruined just about everything.
Yeah, so, but no, I mean, yeah, that's a good call. So third, I love Mexican food. I mean, I don't think you equate romance with Mexican, but you know, you can get the Mariachi band up there, you know, strumming a tune for you and singing along as you enjoy your you know, fajitas,
a
little enchilada action maybe. I don't know. No, I love fajitas and burritos. Like those are my two. And quesadillas. You can't go wrong with a quesadilla. But I don't think we would be like hitting a Mexican restaurant.
So I think we're in agreement, though. Let's wrap this up by just saying I think Italian steakhouse. Yeah, I think we're okay.
1A
and 1B. I'd say seafood steakhouse. Sometimes almost the same. But around here, a lot of you can
a
get
lot
like
of sea. And my poor wife has to suffer, but she will still get. You know, she loves scallops. My wife loves scallops. But to your point, you go to a good steakhouse, they probably have some pretty darn good seafood
or something on the side.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Dix.
Another good discussion about food.
Yeah,
we got the give and go. Might have to venture away from the dinner.
We have
from the
plenty
feedback.
Of topics that we can do this with. That we'll wrap up each time with. So thanks, Dix. A lot of good games this week. Any that you particularly have your eye on that you want to see?
Well, Loyola Hopkins is going to be a great game. You know, Loyola 2-0. I'm sorry, Hopkins 2-0. Loyola coming in after that tough loss. They've had the Blue Jays number the last few years, so I think that game is going to be really interesting. At Notre Dame Georgetown, they're playing in Frisco, Texas. Just excited to see what Notre Dame has. You know, I've been saying I think the Irish are down. Let's see. Georgetown, obviously, last season, real tough year for the Hoyas. Can they bounce back and be a contender in the Big East? I mean, what else do we have on the docket that you're looking at?
All right, so here are some of the sneaky, interesting games that I'm I want to see Bucknell Fairfield. I'll see how Fairfield bounces back.
Bucknell, two consecutive come-from-behind fourth-quarter rallies to win their first two games of 2017.
Villanova-Yale. I want to see what
Yale's
Yale's all about.
Ben Reeves, pretend maybe the best attackman in the country outside of Dylan Malloy.
Penn State-Cornell. Jeff Tambroni and his old squad.
Yeah, and Penn State has been scoring a ton of goals. Mac O'Keefe, the freshman, another 7-point effort in a win against Hobart this past weekend. 14 points in two games for the freshman at Assayas at New York.
Virginia Drexel. We'll see what Coach Volker has in store for Virginia.
Always a dogfight. And is that game up in Philly this year?
I think it is in
Vita Field.
I think it's in Charlottesville.
Oh, okay.
Denver Duke.
Oh, always a great game.
Yeah.
Always a great game.
And Syracuse Albany.
Had that game last year in the first round of the NCAA tournament. Albany had everything going for them in the first half. Syracuse came back. Nice win for Syracuse this past weekend, beating Siena. Mariano and Jordan Evans leading the way for the Orange. I think we got a couple of answers of who's going to play attack for Syracuse, but that'll be a great litmus test. I mean, you talk about Connor Fields and Albany. Those guys can they can run up and down the field. And big question mark for the Danes, though, who takes over for Big Blaze Reardon in the goal for Coach Scott Marr.
So, everybody, enjoy the games. If you want to reach out to us, again, email at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com or on Twitter, it's @DixonLacrosse and @D_fly. If you like what you hear, tell a friend. Our podcasts are free of charge, so catch us on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, talking about D1 lacrosse.
But we would look for a great steakhouse or Italian restaurant to be our sponsor if you'd like to pony up.
Yeah.
I'll start holding my breath right now.
Now.